Hi there, Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Eva, the editor-in-chief of the journal, coming to you today from the absolute best weather that Vancouver has to offer, a beautiful, crisp, blue day as we head into fall. But I have the pleasure today of speaking with a colleague from the other side of the world whose temperatures are headed in the opposite direction. Momentarily, you'll hear the voice of Jill Klein, who is a professor at the Melbourne Business School in the University of Melbourne and also with the University of Melbourne Medical School, and will be discussing a paper that she and her co-author Jeff McCall have coming out in the December 2019 issue of Medical Education entitled Cognitive Dissonance: How Self-Protective Distortions Can Undermine Clinical Judgment. Jill, I'm not going to ask about your cognitive dissonance and deciding whether or not to take the time to record this conversation with me, but I do appreciate you making the time.
Oh, very happy to, and there was no cognitive dissonance whatsoever.
That's probably the place where we need to start, actually. I tend to err on the side of assuming that people are familiar with cognitive dissonance at this point in our history, but for the sake of those who haven't become familiar with the term, can you tell our listeners what it is and why you thought it's something that was important to write about?
So cognitive dissonance is the uncomfortable feeling that we get, or the negative emotion that we experience when we recognize a discrepancy in ourselves. So that could be that we believe something and then learn something that is contrary to that belief. It could be that we engage in a behavior that's inconsistent with our ideals or our values or our beliefs. So anything that creates that kind of discrepancy actually triggers a negative emotional response. And we try and get rid of that negative emotion through all sorts of cognitive gymnastics of rationalizing so that we can bring everything back into alignment and feel better.
Well, and as one goes through that challenging balancing act, it's not necessarily the case that the resolution one comes to create a mistake or an error of some kind, but this is an issue that's been identified by many scholars, particularly in psychology, as being a contributor to some suboptimal decision making. What's your view on the balance of evidence in terms of how people typically resolve dissonance and whether they do so for the better or worse?
Well, often resolving dissonance involves distortion. So generally, it's for the worse. So once we experience that cognitive dissonance and we engage in those distortions, we tend to not see reality quite as clearly as maybe we should. So to give you an example, if you're a doctor and you make a diagnosis and you decide on a path of treatment for a patient, and then you learn that actually some evidence comes along that suggests that maybe your diagnosis was incorrect, that could create cognitive dissonance. So you had a belief, you engaged in behaviors consistent with the belief, and now something inconsistent is occurring to you or is being presented to you. And that's going to create dissonance. And then the question is, what happens because of that? If we go into our self-protective mode, what we're likely to do is downplay that new information. So we will usually resolve dissonance through the path of least resistance. And going back and changing our original diagnosis is impossible, right? Because it's already been done. We've already started treatment. Mm-hmm. We could decide we were wrong and to change course. We could certainly do that. But that means admitting that we're wrong, and that could be a threat to our identity. So an easier thing might be to decide that that test that tells us that the diagnosis might be wrong actually is not that great of a test. The results are kind of in the gray area, and then we discount that information that would be, you know, particularly helpful to us in identifying what's actually going on with the patient.
Right, and one of the intriguing aspects of this paper for me was you are honing in not simply on how the dissonance itself can contribute to error, but how the dissonance hinders our ability to respond when an error is identified, as you just alluded to. So is there an important distinction there between the generation of the error in the first place and the response to it in terms of how issues of dissonance might impact upon us?
Well, I think the process is pretty similar. So it could lead to error in that you stick with an initial hunch that you have rather than being open to new information and counting it as heavily as the information that led to your hunch. And so that could lead to errors in judgment and treatment decisions and so forth. But my particular interest is on how making a medical error creates dissonance and how we resolve that dissonance. And unfortunately, one way we resolve that dissonance is to either blame someone else for the error, fail to acknowledge that an error even happened. You know, there are a number of things we can do to kind of remove ourselves and our identity from that error. And unfortunately, that means we don't learn from our mistakes.
Right, which obviously has implications not just for that moment, but for subsequent encounters with patients and other information. And it puts a particularly fine point on why we need to better understand this process. And I wonder if I can ask you to explain what you went through to generate this paper in terms of trying to put forward a deeper understanding of the phases that one goes through as they're impacted by cognitive dissonance.
Yes, so, you know, I've found that just cognitive dissonance is a psychological process that people find very, very interesting. When I started teaching managerial judgment at Melbourne Business School, I only devoted, you know, 15 minutes to cognitive dissonance as, you know, a process that can lead to cognitive biases. And now it's about an hour and a half or 2 hours, because that's the topic that people wanted to know more about. And then when I started teaching it to clinicians, I also saw, you know, tremendous interest in the topic. And I thought, well, the Cutting Edge series was a real opportunity to discuss what cognitive dissonance is and how it may play out in medical decision making and particularly in medical education. And so I talked with Jeff McCall, my co-author on the piece, who at that point was head of Melbourne Medical School at University of Melbourne, about this issue. And he had done work in the area of arthroscopic knee surgery and evidence that it's not a particularly effective technique for sort of cartilage cleanup. And yet still these procedures are carried out, and he thought that cognitive dissonance might be an important process that's underlying our reticence to move on from old techniques once evidence tells us that they're not all that helpful for patients.
That makes a lot of sense given what I've understood dissonance to be, and there are likely countless examples that we're not even aware of in terms of places in which it might play out. I'm not going to actually go into a lot of those detailed examples, but I think inevitably people will want to know, what do you do about it? And this is one paper in a long history of articles in our field looking at the types of errors that people make in their reasoning processes, and it's always quite contentious in terms of, can we actually do something about it, or are these things that are just labels that we're applying? What advice do you have for those who are trying to figure out how to grapple with this?
Yes, well, fortunately, there's been a lot of work on moderators. You know, what are the things that enhance, reduce cognitive dissonance or the distortion? They've been able to draw on that, apply it to medical settings. This article is a call to do that research. But if we extrapolate from other settings into the medical setting or the clinical setting, there are a few things that we could do to help reduce the problems caused by dissonance. And let's take that into the medical education realm. So let's talk about this in terms of, say, supervising a resident or a trainee or an intern or a medical student. So let's say they have made a mistake in how they handled something with a patient. We know that cognitive dissonance only occurs if people perceive that they had a choice in the decision they made. So if you are forced to espouse this opinion, and you said the opinion, and it was counter to your usual opinions, you would experience no dissonance because you had no choice in the matter. And so we know from research that the degree to which people feel like they had a free choice to engage in the action that they engaged in, that increases their sense of dissonance. And so let's say there's a situation where you have an intern who was following prescripted protocol in how to treat a patient, but something went wrong. One thing that you could do is remind them, hey, you know, you were doing exactly what the guidelines tell you to do. What you didn't notice was that the patient was responding in this way, something that's really important to look for, right? And with that kind of approach, reminding them that they didn't have a lot of choice in how they treated the patient, that might make it less likely that they even experienced dissonance to begin with, and make it more likely that they will be open to what you have to say and learn from the experience.
Well, and that's an interesting and important layer, I think, to this conversation that is distinct from much of the other literature on cognitive biases of one form or another. Is in your response, you're very clearly indicating a value of having others around you to share perspective and to people who are trained to understand these moderators and therefore might help others overcome biases that one may not be able to get through on their own. Is that where you're taking this idea?
Definitely, because a supervisor or a colleague, what they say in these sorts of difficult situations where dissonance might be aroused, what they say can make a huge difference. Like if I went up to you, Kevin, and I said, look, you know that decision you made 3 months ago about the journal? Well, now I'm seeing evidence that suggests you were wrong.
Right? I can show you lots of evidence.
But I mean, basically, I've just said to you, Kevin, experience cognitive dissonance and resolve your dissonance through deciding that it's not worth listening to me. You know, use me as the path of least resistance to resolve your dissonance.
Right.
So, but if I said to you, you know, Kevin, when we on the board made that decision about a direction to take the journal, and we knew at the time that there were uncertainties and that we would have to kind of watch for how things eventuated. And I've taken that to heart, and I've really kept my ear to the ground, and here's what I'm hearing, and here's my concern. So that approach to the issue is going to leave you much, much more open to discussion, to hearing what I have to say, because there's much less threat inherent in the approach that I've used.
Right, and really nice blending then of the thinking about psychological processes in terms of how they're impacted upon by the broader social and or cultural environments, and the exploration of moderators then, if I've understood correctly, is in part about how do we enable people in this environment to support others rather than how do we teach the every person to never make this type of mistake.
Yes, no, that's exactly right. And, you know, I think we often struggle with what do we say to people when they're having a bad day, when they've made a mistake that's hurt somebody. And I hope this article helps give people some ideas. So, for example, the core of cognitive dissonance is a threat to one's self-esteem. That's why we experience the dissonance. That's why we try and repair it. We're trying to repair our identity. So if I'm a junior doctor and I feel very competent in what I'm doing and I make an error, that's a blow to my self-esteem. And as supervisors, we can't pretend the error didn't happen in order to protect the person's self-esteem. That is not what we should be doing, right? We have to learn from errors. We have to get used to making errors. But we can say things that can support the person through that process and help learning experience.
That's actually a really good place for us to wrap up this conversation, knowing that we can't get into all the details. But I think one of the things you've just reminded me of and is really nicely highlighted in the paper is the importance of not just taking at face value that dissonance occurs, because I think we can very confidently say that it does, but what work do we need to do in the health professions and in health professional education to really understand which of the moderators that you've summarized in this paper transfer to these settings and what's unique about these settings that could better position people to provide this sort of support that you're describing.
That's right. And I think, you know, most of the research on cognitive dissonance has not been carried out in high-stakes settings, you know, where it's usually been where mistakes or the dissonance that's caused is over something, you know, it might be something big or central to the person, but it's not something like making a medical error where somebody could die. And so I'm particularly interested in how cognitive dissonance works in a situation where, you know, you could be struggling with the dissonance of an event for years after the event. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to look at ways that we could make that journey easier for healthcare professionals who I think are very brave to be putting themselves in a situation where they're working in such a high-stakes environment.
Absolutely. And for that reason, I want to thank you for doing this work and drawing our attention to these issues. And I will encourage our listeners to go and take a look at the details. The paper, as I mentioned at the start, is called Cognitive Dissonance, How Self-Protective Distortions Can Undermine Clinical Judgment. You'll find it in the December 2019 issue under the name of Jill Klein. Thanks, Jill, very much for sharing these ideas with us, and look forward to hearing where it leads.
That's great. Thanks very much, Kevin. Thanks for including me.